was enormously relieved. From the moment Gryzlov set Stacy Ann Barbeau's political rally at Barksdale Air Force Base as Shach Imat's first target, he had been focused on the dangers involved in carrying out a military operation that could easily kill or wound America's national leader, even if only by accident.
"Spare me the standard briefing boilerplate, Vladimir."
Gryzlov nodded the other man toward a chair.
"I want solid numbers."
"Yes, sir."
Kurykin pulled out his own smartphone. He opened up several files.
"From satellite photos, my analysts estimate that 14 of our KH-35 missiles hit their assigned targets."
"And the other two?"
"One detonated prematurely seconds before impact," Kurykin said. "The other appears to have crashed in the swamps east of the airbase, probably due to an engine or avionics failure of some kind."
"So the Americans will find it?"
"Eventually," Kurykin agreed. He shrugged his shoulders.
"But even then, the wreckage shouldn't lead their investigations anywhere."
Gryzlov nodded. "Besides Russia, at least 8 other countries around the world used the same subsonic cruise missiles. Many of them were building their own versions of the KH-35 under license or reverse engineering their own designs. No one would be shocked by the possibility that some of them had filtered out onto the international arms black market. As an added precaution, the missile components shipped covertly by Anyankov and his men had been thoroughly sanitized, stripped of any identifying serial numbers. That would certainly arouse suspicion, but it would also delay any investigation.
"Has your 737 returned to its base?"
Gryzlov asked.
"It landed in Utah an hour ago," Kurykin confirmed. "Anyankov has made his scheduled stop at Dallas-Fort Worth and then continued on as planned without any delay."
He smiled thinly.
"In the circumstances, the local airport officials were only too glad to expedite the departure of as many aircraft as possible."
"I can imagine,"
Gryzlov said dryly. News of the attack had caused the American FAA to temporarily ground or reroute all passenger and cargo flights scheduled to pass anywhere within a couple of 100 miles of Barksdale. Naturally, the effects had rippled across the entire United States, spreading havoc as connecting flights were canceled or delayed. With eastbound passenger jets and air freighters stacking up at their gates and on their runways, Dallas-Fort Worth's managers had no interest in holding up planes headed in other directions. He leaned forward.
"How about your ground units? What's their status?"
"The trucks carrying Baruchev's KVMs and Aristov's covering force have reached our safe house in Dallas,"
Kurykin continued.
"Again, without incident."
Like the sites Aristov's teams had set up in several other places across the U.S., the Dallas secure site was a warehouse nominally owned by FXR Trucking. Most were located on the outskirts of cities and large towns, in busy industrial parks where no one would be surprised by trucks and other vehicles coming and going at all hours of the day and night. As far as FXR's American corporate executives were concerned, these warehouses now belonged to yet another fledgling subsidiary funded by the company's new owners. Employees who once worked in those warehouses had either been transferred to other facilities or laid off with generous severance packages.
"Very good," Gryzlov said. "Now, how much damage did your war machines inflict?"
Kurykin smiled more broadly.
"More than my planner's most optimistic hopes. For once, the American media is not exaggerating. Colonel Baruchev's robots destroyed every single military aircraft on the ground at Barksdale."
"All of them?"
"Yes, Mr. President," Kurykin said proudly, "including Air Force One."
Gryzlov felt a huge, answering smile of his own spread across his face. With one blow, he'd further ravaged the already weakened American strategic bomber force and wiped out an entire squadron of its most advanced stealth fighters. Best of all, there was no indication that Barbeau or her advisors had any idea that Russia was responsible for this attack. To his surprise, the American president hadn't even raised the alert status of her forces beyond DEFCON 3. In fact, there were no signs of any unusual activity by ground, air, or naval units deployed outside the continental United States. It was a very different story at military bases on U.S. soil. Satellite imagery and signals intercepts all showed that they were on high alert, with fighters and early warning aircraft aloft on patrol. Their combat squadrons and other air units were being dispersed to alternate fields. Army units had been deployed to nearby military bases and high-value government buildings, and Reserve and National Guards units had been activated. The picture those facts painted was clear. The Americans did not know they had been attacked by a foreign power. They were taking purely defensive measures, not preparing to conduct a retaliatory strike against an identified aggressor. Which meant that Gryzlov's plan, in all its cunning permutations, was unfolding just as he had intended.
"Do you have any idea of how many casualties you caused?" Gryzlov asked.
"No precise numbers," Kurykin said. He shrugged. "I don't think even the Americans have an exact count yet,
but they were substantial. My best guess would be that we killed or badly wounded several hundred of the enemy, including many of their best pilots."
"Molodets! Well done,"
Gryzlov told Kurykin, openly delighted. For years, the Americans and their hirelings had battered Russia and its allies, often without paying any significant price. Exacting a measure of revenge for those years of pain and humiliation was incredibly satisfying. Knowing that this was only the beginning was even better.
"I'd have you convey my personal congratulations directly to RKU's troops and pilots, Vladimir," he grinned. "Except, of course, that might imply I have some knowledge of your criminal and wholly unauthorized actions."
"I can't imagine what you're referring to, Mr. President," Kurykin agreed, with an answering smile of his own.
"After all, I was never here."
Gryzlov nodded approvingly.
"Of course not."
His eyes hardened.
"So, when do you plan to strike your next target?"
"My forces can be ready to strike again within 24 hours,
Kurykin promised. The Russian president held up a hand.
"Not so fast," he said with a sly smile. "Поспешишь, люди не смешишь,"
he continued, quoting an old proverb.
"If you hurry, you'll just make others laugh. Give the Americans a little more time to work themselves into a frenzy, eh? Let them sit and wonder and fret about what's going on, while they exhaust their pilots and policemen with fruitless searches and patrols. Then, once they begin to relax, that will be the time to hit them hard again."
21. The Governor's Mansion, Austin, Texas. That same time. While the White House will not confirm it, informed sources close to the president tell CNN that she is currently aboard one of the nation's airborne command centers, and that she is directly coordinating the federal government's response to this vicious terrorist attack against the United States. Her likely opponent in the fall, Governor Farrell, remains huddled in his mansion, meeting with political advisors. With a snort, John Dalton Farrell turned off the television in his book-lined office. He turned to the group of men and women gathered around the antique oak ranch table set in the middle of the modest-sized room.
"Well, there you have it, folks." He gave them a lopsided grin. "Apparently, we're the ones cowering in a corner, while Stacy Ann Barbeau heroically leads the fight from inside a heavily guarded airplane flying around at 40,000 feet.
"Jesus," one of them murmured. "Those bastards in the media aren't even pretending to be unbiased anymore. That so-called news report might as well be a full-on Barbeau campaign commercial." Farrell shrugged.
"No one ever said this would be easy, did they?"
Seeing their glum faces, he deliberately struck a dramatic pose.
"Was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor? Hell no!"
His senior campaign staffers groaned. Sure, their boss's love for occasionally quoting old movies like Animal House was endearing, but they couldn't help worrying that a hostile press would hear about him joking like this and use what he said out of context to paint him as an uneducated moron.
Farrell relented. Okay, so the press hates my guts and worships the ground Stacy Ann treads on. Well, we knew that going in. Nothing's changed, except that now we need to figure out exactly what I'm going to say about this terrorist attack on Barksdale Air Force Base, and it sure looks like against the president herself. They nodded. The boilerplate condemnation the campaign had released earlier was good enough as far as it went, but they needed something more concrete. Except for his criticism of Barbeau's weakness toward the Russians and the crony defense contracts she doled out to big contributors, most of the governor's focus had been on domestic policy. Today's horrific assault on a major American military installation was guaranteed to shift public attention to national security and defense policy, which was, traditionally, a boon for any Oval Office incumbent.
You think they were really trying to kill her? Sarah Patel asked skeptically.
The University of Chicago-educated daughter of Indian immigrants, she was Farrell's top aide for trade policy.
You saw the videos, he said. There were one heck of a lot of bullets and missiles flying around out there at Barksdale. If whoever hit us there wasn't really trying to kill President Barbeau, they sure as shit made it look that way.
Slowly she nodded.
Well, crap, Governor. If these terrorists were actually gunning for her, it's too bad they missed.
Huh. Michael Dowell said with a cynical laugh. Dowell, short and wiry with the build and aggressive attitude of a welterweight boxer, was an acknowledged expert on banking regulation and small business formation.
It would have saved us a few $100 million in projected campaign spending.
He fell abruptly silent when Farrell turned an icy glare on him.
Stacy Ann Barbeau is still our president, and this nation's commander-in-chief, Mike.
The powerfully built Texan said coldly,
You may not like it. Hell, I don't like it. Which is why I plan to beat her like a dirty rug come November. But in the meantime, everyone in this room will show the proper respect due her office. Is that understood?
Dowell stared at the table for a moment and then quietly agreed.
Yes, Governor.
Good,
Farrell growled. He looked around the crowded room.
And we will make damn sure we don't fall into the trap of siding, even rhetorically, with the assholes who've just killed and wounded so many America's brave soldiers and airmen. Is that clear enough for y'all?
They nodded quickly, with murmured, embarrassed-sounding assents. For a moment longer, Farrell stared them down. These were good people, he knew, smart people. But like a lot of smart people, sometimes they lost sight of the forest for the trees. For all her many faults and manifest failings, Stacy Ann Barbeau was still a fellow American. Yes, he was in this campaign to win, but he wasn't in it to lose his soul along the way. Suddenly his smartphone started playing music, indicating that he was receiving an incoming call. He stared down at it in surprise. Not only had he set the phone to vibrate, but that snippet of Aaron Copland's Billy the Kid was not the ringtone he had set. To his wife's occasional dismay, he was more of a country and western fan, which meant someone had hacked the device. In and of itself, that wasn't a crisis. Unlike a lot of people, Farrell used his smartphone sparingly, and never for anything seriously confidential. His aides sometimes joked that if their boss had his way, he'd still be transacting official business by telegram and mounted courier. For a brief moment, he considered handing the problem off to his security people, but then his natural curiosity got the better of him. Whoever was responsible had gone to a lot of time and trouble to set this up. Why not find out who? Farrell looked up at his advisors with an apologetic look.
If y'all don't mind, I need to take this in private. Let's take a short break and come back at this in 10 minutes.
Once they'd filed out, clutching their array of briefing books and personal laptops, he swiped a calloused finger across the smartphone's screen to accept this mysterious call. But instead of connecting, his swipe activated software hidden deep inside its operating system. Rows of random, seeming numbers and symbols float across the screen and then vanished. Level 5 encryption program active, link fully secure, appeared in their place,
followed immediately by the live video picture of a man with longish gray hair and a neatly trimmed gray beard. He looked back from the screen with a hint of amusement. Farrell raised an eyebrow.
And there I'd thought your reputation for pulling technological rabbits out of the hat was something exaggerated, Mr. President. I guess I was wrong about that.
I apologize for this unexpected intrusion, Governor, Martindale said, though without sounding very sorry. But since President Barbeau seems determined to make the same foolish mistakes over and over again, I need to brief you on what Pyotr Vilk and I believe is actually happening.
Wolf 6-2, over the Navajo Nation Reservation, Arizona. The next night. 270 nautical miles and 36 minutes after crossing into U.S. airspace, roughly halfway between El Paso and Nogales, the XCV-62 Ranger zoomed low over high alpine forests, sharp-edged canyons and cliffs. Against a night sky speckled with thousands of stars and the softly glowing band of the Milky Way, the Iron Wolf stealth aircraft was nothing more than a dark shadow rippling across a pitch-black landscape empty of any man-made light. Brad McClanahan pulled his stick gently to the left, banking to follow the glowing navigation cues on his HUD. A jagged pillar of rock slid past outside the right side of the cockpit and then vanished astern. Without his input, the XCV-62 pitched up slightly, streaked over a low rise, and then descended again before leveling off just 200 feet above the ground. They were relying on the Ranger's digital terrain following system to keep them safe, even at 450 knots. Using detailed, digitized maps stored in the aircraft's computers and repeated short bursts from its radar altimeter, the DTF system allowed feats of long-distance, low-altitude flying would be almost impossible for any unaided human pilot. AN-APY-2, pulse Doppler radar still active. Bearing now 4 o'clock. Estimated range is 150 miles, their computer reported. Detection probability at this altitude remains virtually nil. In the Ranger's right-hand seat, Major Nadia Rozek leaned forward. She checked the menu on her threat warning display, watching as the computer compared the signature of the radar emissions it was picking up against its database.
That is the same E3 Sentry we saw earlier, she told him.
Brad nodded tightly, keeping his eyes on his HUD.
Yeah. They must be circling over Kirtland AFB outside of Albuquerque. There's a huge underground nuclear weapons storage complex on the base. Nobody there wants to get blindsided by another cruise missile attack.
Even before the XCV-62 crossed the U.S. border from Mexico, they'd started picking up the emissions of several E-3 Sentry AWACS aircraft deployed to cover the Air Force bases in Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. Each of the modified Boeing 707s had a 30-foot diameter rotating radar dome mounted atop its fuselage. Their radars could scan huge volumes of airspace, spotting non-stealth targets out as far as 200-plus miles. And where those radar warning planes were, he knew pairs of F-16 and F-15 fighters were bound to be orbiting also, ready to intercept any unidentified aircraft the sentries detected. Slipping through this airborne web without setting off alarms meant flying an intricately plotted course at extremely low altitude, using the rugged terrain so prevalent in the American Southwest to mask their passage wherever possible. So far, they'd been fortunate. The Air Force had deployed its limited number of AWACS aircraft pretty much as Brad had predicted. There were gaps in effective radar coverage they could exploit. Following the cues on his HUD, he banked left again. Harder this time. With his left hand, he pushed the throttles forward a scooch, adding power to the engines to keep his airspeed up through this tighter turn. Then he leveled out again and reduced power, decreasing their thermal signature. They were flying northwest now, headed directly into the badlands of Utah's Grand Staircase, Escalante National Monument. Once the Ranger broke free of that labyrinth of canyons, cliffs, and soaring buttes and mesas, they should have a straight shot to Battle Mountain in northern Nevada. 350 nautical miles farther on, the Iron Wolf stealth transport swooped low over a jagged ridge and dropped back down into a wide, lifeless valley. Brad peered through his HUD. More high ground spread across the horizon. Seen through their forward-looking night vision cameras, those steep, rocky slopes took on a green-hued glow. Nevada was the most mountainous state in the Union, with over 150 named ranges and 30 separate peaks that soared more than 11,000 feet into the air. He blinked away a droplet of sweat. His flight suit was soaked. Even with all their advanced avionic and navigation systems, this prolonged nap-of-the-earth flight was imposing a serious strain on both his mind and his body.
"Not much longer now, Brad," Nadia said quietly, offering him some encouragement.
He forced a tired grin.
"Caution. S-band multifunction phased array radar detected at 10 o'clock. Range approximately 40 miles, the ranger's computer reported. Evaluated as Skymaster's Argus 5. Detection probability low, but rising.
That was the advanced civilian-grade radar sighted at McClanahan's Industrial Airport, one of John Master's last designs. It was almost as capable as some of the U.S. military's top-end radar systems, and at a fraction of the cost.
"Nice to see that our friends are awake," Brad muttered.
"Can you blame them?" Nadia said. "By now, Dr. Noble and the others at Skymasters must know the Russians have their own combat robots. They are wise to take precautions against unexpected and unwelcome guests."
He shook his head. "No, I can't blame them, but the fact that they've got that big-ass radar powered up this late is going to make things a little trickier."
"Perhaps Martindale should have warned them we were coming."
"Too risky," Brad countered. "It's unlikely that the Feds or the Russians have penetrated Skymaster's communications, but if either of them has..." He let the thought trail off.
Nadia sighed. "It would be a very bad day for us."
"Yep. So the name of the game tonight is still how to not be seen," he thought for a moment. "Bring up Nav Plan 2.
"Understood. Going to Nav Plan 2.
Nadia pulled up her navigation display. Deftly, she entered commands instructing their computer to switch to one of the several alternate flight plans Brad had plotted before leaving Poland. Their cues on his HUD shifted immediately. Brad tugged the stick to the right, pulling the Ranger into a tight turn toward the north. This new course would take them around the outer edge of the Argus 5's radar detection envelope. Once they put the concealing mass of the Sheep Creek Range between them and the Skymaster's operated airport, they could safely swing back south. Land-based radars could not see through higher ground.
"New S-band Doppler radar detected at 11 o'clock, the computer said suddenly. "Signal strength increasing."
That was the kicker, Brad knew. Evading the Skymaster's Argus 5 meant flying almost straight into the zone of another radar. This one sighted high up in the Sheep Creek's range's jumble of high plateaus, rounded rises, and boulder-strewn washes. The good news was that this new radar was one of the U.S. Weather Service's NEXRAD stations, and that gave them a chance to spoof it without being noticed.
"Activate Spear," he told Nadia. "Target that S-band Doppler weather radar."
Her fingers danced across one of her MFDs, bringing their ALQ-293 Self-Protection Electronically Agile Reaction System online. Spear transmitted carefully tailored signals on the same frequencies used by radars hunting for their XCV-62. By altering the timing of pulses returned to a potentially hostile radar, it could trick that radar into thinking the Ranger was somewhere else in the sky, or even render it effectively invisible.
"Spear is engaged," she said. "Matching frequencies."
Crossing his fingers mentally, Brad held his course north. Since the primary mission of the WSR 88D radars in the NEXRAD network was weather tracking, they were highly automated. Plus, any meteorologist who was up so late keeping tabs on this particular radar should be paying more attention to cold fronts, thunderstorms, and the like than a single tiny blip that quickly faded off his or her screen.
"NEXRAD radar now at 10 o'clock, range 30 miles.
"Nice theory, McClanahan," Brad thought, trying not to hold his breath. Now to see if it matched reality.
They were almost broadside to that radar now, without any terrain between them high enough to provide cover. If they were going to get pinged, this was the time.
Seconds passed.
each seeming longer than the last while the ranger streaked on, flying low over the arid Nevada desert.
No detection, Nadia said finally, with mingled relief and satisfaction. Spear has control over that radar.
It can't see us.
Copy that.
Brad tweaked his stick again, following the steering cues on his HUD as they slid left a few degrees and then kept moving, starting our final turn toward the LZ. The XCV-62 banked slightly, starting a long, curving turn that would bring them back around to the southwest, coming in along the spine of the Sheep Creek Range. The aircraft's nose pitched up, climbing to stay above the fast-approaching high ground. Brad started throttling back, slowly shedding airspeed. Beside him, Nadia had her eyes fixed on a computer-generated map.
"We are 3 minutes out from the landing zone," she told him.
"No visual yet," Brad said tightly.
They were roughly 14 nautical miles out from the straight stretch of little-used dirt road he'd picked out earlier from satellite imagery as a possible place to land. It was still hidden in among the rugged hills and gullies ahead of them.
"DTF disengaged," he said, toggling a control on his stick that turned off the ranger's terrain-following system.
He pulled back slightly, gaining more altitude to take a look at their planned LZ. Their airspeed dropped to 300 knots. Abruptly, a cursor blinked into existence on his HUD.
"There it is. 90 seconds out."
Nadia slaved on one of her MFDs to their forward-looking passive sensors and zoomed in her view.
"The LZ appears clear. I am not picking up any unidentified thermal contacts."
Brad nodded. Except for occasional hikers, no one spent much time this high up in the Sheep Creek Range. Through his HUD, he could see the dirt road rolling away into the distance. It was a thin, bright green line against the darker green of the surrounding plateau. Using another control on his stick, he selected a touchdown point. Instantly, the ranger's navigation system updated his steering cues.
"We're go for landing."
60 seconds out,"
Nadia tapped a key, alerting their passengers in the troop compartment that they were making their final approach. Brad entered a quick command on one of his own MFDs, configuring for a short field rough landing. Then he throttled back some more. The Iron Wolf aircraft slid lower. The muffled roar from the Ranger's four turbofan engines diminished fast. As their airspeed dropped, hydraulics whined shrilly. Computer-directed control surfaces opened along the trailing edge of the wing, providing more lift. The XCV-62's nose gear and twin-mounted bogies swung down and locked in position. The dirt road, with a glowing line down across it to mark Brad's desired touchdown point, loomed ahead through his windscreen, growing larger quickly as they descended. They came in low over the road, thundering along just feet above the ground. His left hand hovered over the throttles. 100 yards, 50 yards, 25 yards. The computer-drawn touchdown marker was suddenly a fiery green blaze across his whole HUD.
"Landing now,"
he said decisively. With a smooth motion, he chopped the throttles back almost all the way. The Iron Wolf stealth transport dropped out of the sky. It touched down with a sharp jolt, shaking and rattling hard as it bounded down the rutted dirt road. Plumes of dust and sand kicked loose by its passage drifted away in a light breeze. Quickly, Brad reversed the thrust, gradually bringing them to a full stop about 1,000 feet from where the ranger's landing gear first kissed the earth. For a moment, he sat still, breathing hard. Then he grinned over at Nadia.
"Well, check off one more successful landing in this crate, or depending on how you look at it, one more narrowly avoided crash."
She made a show of peering out both sides of the cockpit and then looked back at him with a crooked smile of her own.
"Since the aircraft does seem to be in one piece, I suppose your more optimistic appraisal is warranted."
She turned more serious.
"Now what?"
"Now we drop the ramp and have Captain Schofield and his merry band of scouts guide us to a somewhat less conspicuous position a little off this road. Before the sun comes up, we need to be out of sight, especially from the air."
30 minutes later, The ranger was parked near the opening of a draw, lined with sagebrush just east of the road they'd used as an improvised landing strip. Schofield and one of his men were draping cyan-designed camouflage netting across the aircraft to shield it from visual, thermal, or radar detection. The rest were hard at work smoothing out the tracks left by the aircraft's gear when it taxied into this hiding place. Inside the cockpit, Nadia opened a comm window on her display and typed in a short message reporting their safe arrival. Their computer automatically encrypted, compressed, and transmitted her message via satellite. An icon flashed within seconds, signaling an acknowledgement and urgent message.
"It's from Martindale," she said to Brad and Wack Maycomber.
Her brow furrowed as she read through the decoded message.
"He urges us to exercise extreme caution. We are to avoid detection by U.S. authorities at all costs."
With an exasperated sigh, she glanced up at the two Americans.
"Apparently, your President Barbeau is more than half convinced that we are the ones responsible for destroying your country's bomber base."
"This just gets better and better," Maycomber growled. "How the fuck are we supposed to smack down a raid on Skymasters without being spotted? I don't care how nifty keen these Mod 4 CIDs are. All the frickin' camo systems in the world won't hide a railgun shot or autocannon fire."
"Oh, once that happens, we don't have to hide any longer, Colonel," Nadia said with forced good cheer. "It's simple. When the Russians do attack, we kill them. Then we show their wrecked machines and mangled corpses to your government." She shrugged. "That should be proof enough, even for a short-sighted cretin like your president. And then we can all go home without all this sneaking around."
That drew a reluctant, rare laugh from Maycomber. Brad joined in, glad that Nadia could still shake Wack out of his occasional fits of gloom. Inwardly, though, he couldn't shake a nagging worry of his own. What had appeared an obvious course of action back in Poland seemed a lot less obvious now that they were here on the ground deep inside the States. Sure, realistically, he and the others had no way to hunt down the covert forces Gennady Gryzlov was using to attack the U.S. There were too many possible hiding places, and America was just too big a country. All of which made stationing their CIDs on Overwatch near Battle Mountain the only rational play. Viewed logically, Skymasters had to be a top priority target for the Russians. Now that Moscow had its own combat robots, the high-tech weapons and other equipment developed by Skymasters were sure to be the key to survival for Poland, its allies, and the United States itself. They were essentially employing the same tactics used by big game hunters when setting out to bag a tiger in the trackless jungle. Instead of beating around futilely in the bush, the idea was to stake out a live goat as bait, and then lie in wait until the hungry big cat came prowling into your rifle sights. Well, Skymasters was their bait. But what if the tiger had other prey in mind? That was the worry Brad couldn't shake. What if he'd misread Gryzlov's plans? Then what?
22. RKU Secure Site, Dallas, Texas. That same time. Unhurriedly, Kirill Aristov sauntered along the withered grass strip lining the north side of Irving Avenue. His hands were buried in his pockets. He came to the corner of a small side street and paused, looking around in all directions as if making sure it was safe to cross. Under the crumpled brim of an oil-stained baseball cap, his eyes were watchful. A few cars and trucks drove past in directions along the wide six-lane avenue, but no one seemed to be paying any real attention to him. His lips thinned. After all, why should they? This late at night, the only people wandering out on the streets were either drunk or crazy or homeless, or most likely all three in combination. Satisfied that he was clear, Aristov strolled on up the narrower side street. Halfway down the block, he came to a padlocked chain-link gate. A rusting sign wired to the gate warned passers-by that this was an FXR trucking facility and that trespassers would be prosecuted, or right now, quite probably shot and killed, he murmured to himself. He
He dug a key out of his jeans pocket, unlocked the gate, pulled it open just far enough to squeeze through, and then relocked the gate behind him. With only three tractor trailers backed up against a single slab-sized steel warehouse, the lot looked almost empty, especially when compared to those of the dozen other much busier trucking companies and freight lines operating out of this run-down industrial neighborhood. Over time, Aristov supposed this lack of activity might strike FXR's rivals as odd. Fortunately, he and his men, along with Berushev's war robots, would be gone long before anyone got too curious. After one last slow look around to make sure no one was watching, he crossed the parking lot to the warehouse, rapped twice on a door, and then went straight in. With a curt nod, Pavel Lerianov slid his pistol back out of sight. The former Spetsnaz sergeant sat back down behind a solid metal desk that faced the door. A bank of TV monitors showed grainy images captured by low-light security cameras set up at various points outside the warehouse.
"Any trouble?"
he asked.
"None," Aristov said.
He'd gone out earlier to walk around the neighboring area, looking for any signs that they were drawing unwelcome attention, either from the Dallas police or from America's domestic spy agency, the FBI. He'd figured that it would be a lot harder to hide a law enforcement surveillance operation now that things were quieting down outside. And he'd been right. The panel vans and unmarked cars favored by the police and the FBI would have stood out like lions among alley cats on those early empty streets. They were still safely hidden here. Nikolai Dubrunin met him just inside the main warehouse.
"We've received a new warning order from Moscow. General Kurykin wants us to hit our next scheduled target in 48 hours.
Aristov looked past him to where several men stood grouped around a folding card table. The KVM pilots were studying maps while their leader, Colonel Berushev, ran through yet another proposed attack plan.
"Do they know about this additional delay?"
Dubrunin nodded. Aristov frowned. Berushev and his pilots should be grabbing some sack time right now. What were they doing awake this late, especially after learning they wouldn't be going into action for two more nights? If any of them had slept for more than a couple of hours after reaching this secure site, he'd missed it. Quietly, he said as much to Dubrunin.
"I've asked about that. Berushev and his men claim they don't need much sleep," the other man said carefully. "Apparently they're taking it in turns to spend some time plugged into those war robots of theirs."
"For what purpose?"
Dubrunin lowered his voice. "Those machines included advanced medical diagnostics and health maintenance systems. While they're hooked up, these guys filter out the fatigue toxins from their bloodstreams. Plus, they can juice up on different hormones and neurotransmitters. So Berushev and the rest of his KVM pilots are screwing around with their brain and body chemistry in order to go without sleep?"
Aristov frowned.
"Does that sound like a good idea to you?"
The other man shrugged.
"In combat, maybe. But outside of an emergency situation, hell no."
He looked at his team leader with a worried expression.
"Should we report this to Moscow? Without more evidence, this behavior is causing a problem?"
Aristov said slowly. Reluctantly, he shook his head.
"No. The colonel and his men have been trained on these war robots. We haven't. They must know what they're doing."
"I hope so." Dubrunin sounded unconvinced. Aristov slapped him gently on the shoulder.
"That makes two of us, Nikolai."
His eyes hardened.
"Which is why we are going to keep a very close eye on them from now on, just to make sure."
Battle Mountain, Nevada. Several hours later. Rubbing at bleary eyes that felt like they'd been sandpapered, Hunter Boomer Noble slid behind the wheel of his Lincoln luxury sedan, hit its push-button ignition, and then bit down on a ferocious yawn.
"Do not start that, or you'll never stop," he thought tiredly.
Instead, he ordered,
"Open the pod bay doors, Hal."
The integrated voice command system he'd set up to control the lights, air conditioning, and other electronics in the house he was renting instantly obeyed. With a low rumble, the garage door rolled up, revealing a row of large two-story homes across the street. With the sun still below the eastern horizon, lights showed behind only a few windows. Carefully, Boomer backed out of the garage, down his driveway, and out onto the empty street. No other cars were in sight. Naturally. His neighbors were mostly up-and-coming executives, working for some of the other tech companies lured to Battle Mountain by Skymaster's presence and subcontracts. But not even the eagerest beaver among them made a habit of heading to the office at this ungodly hour. That was a pleasure reserved for top-level Skymaster's executives and engineers since the bolt from the Blue sneak attack on Barksdale Air Force Base. He put the Lincoln in gear and drove off. Behind him, his garage door rolled back down and locked automatically. Boomer rolled to the nearest stop sign and took a left onto a bigger street that would take him to Interstate 80. Suddenly, his headlights picked out a man wearing jeans, hiking boots, and a hooded maroon MIT sweatshirt standing right in the middle of the road, apparently trying to thumb a ride.
Oh, man. You have got to be kidding me, he snarled under his breath.
Now they were getting guys to bum rides in his suburban neighborhood, and practically in the middle of the night? This was the kind of crap that people moved out of places like Las Vegas or San Francisco to escape. What was next? Upscale panhandlers trying to rustle spare change for a round of golf at the local public course? Still grousing out loud to himself, Boomer started to pull around the would-be hiker. Then he saw the crude, hand-lettered sign the other man held up. It read, "Will work for food for my wolf."
Ah, hell, he muttered with almost resigned incredulity. And here I thought today would be boring.
Scowling, he jammed on his brakes, bringing the big Lincoln to a full stop next to the hitchhiker. Silent now, he waited while the other man popped open the passenger door, climbed in, and flipped back the hood of his sweatshirt.
"Well, this is just great," Boomer said with a wry smile. "So, Bradley James McClanahan has come to call. With all hell breaking loose in the world, I should have figured out you'd be dropping by to visit your old pal Hunter Noble and his Skymaster's hangar full of super-duper high-tech wonder planes."
"Nice to see you, too," Brad replied with a lopsided grin. "Hope I didn't startle you too much," he shrugged.
"I'd have picked a less cloak-and-dagger way to get in touch, but I'm not supposed to be in the States at all, let alone here in Battle Mountain."
Boomer snorted.
"No kidding. If there's anyone else in the world who's more non grata as a persona, with both the Feds and the Russians, than you and your Iron Wolf compadres, I'd be very surprised."
He raised an eyebrow.
"Which makes me curious as to just how far you're planning to ride with me this morning."
"All the way to your office," Brad said simply.
"I need to brief you on some developments, and I'd rather not do it outside a secure environment."
"Yeah. See, there's the problem," Boomer told him with a frown.
"Our corporate security guys have gotten a lot twitchier since someone kicked the crap out of Barksdale. They aren't exactly going to let you come waltzing through the gate, even on my say-so."
In response, the younger man unzipped his sweatshirt. A Skymaster's ID card was clipped to the shirt of his pocket. Made out in the name of someone named Michael Kelly, it showed a recent photo of Brad wearing a coat and tie, and it looked completely genuine. Not only that, but the ID indicated that he was a special projects engineer for Skymaster's aerospace unit. The same outfit headed up by one Dr. Hunter Noble, Ph.D. Boomer stared at it for a long second. Then he shook his head in disgust.
"Don't tell me. That shiny new ID of yours is already planted in our personal system too, right?"
"Yep."
Boomer let out a breath.
"How the hell did Martindale..." Then he stopped himself and just held up a hand with a deep, frustrated sigh.
"Never mind. I really do not want to know."
He grimaced. Every time the former U.S. president and current head of Cyan pulled one of these spooky stunts,
Skymaster's security people scrambled around like maniacs trying to plug whatever gaps he'd found in their systems. Martindale was one of the company's best customers, despite Stacy Ann Barbeau's efforts to close off their sales to him, so this was more like a game than anything more serious. But it was still a game Boomer was getting tired of losing. "Mind telling me what you're up to?" he asked finally.
"Right now?"
Brad offered him a seriously shit-eating grin.
"I'm going to grab a little shut-eye on the way into work. I put in a couple of incredibly long days just getting here, you know?"
With that, he reclined the Lincoln's comfortable leather passenger seat and closed his eyes. Idly complaining whether his neighbors would really mind so much finding a corpse sprawled across one of their nice, neat streets when they woke up, Boomer took his foot off the brake and drove toward Skymaster's. Brad looked around Boomer's cluttered office while the other man sat down and fired up his office computer. Stacks of aircraft manuals, binders crammed full of engine specifications and test results, and printouts of other scientific and engineering data occupied almost every flat surface. Detailed models of every aircraft and spacecraft Hunter Noble had ever flown lined the shelves behind him. He nodded at one of them, a 1/64th scale version of the sleek, single-stage-to-orbit S-19 Midnight spaceplane. It was a cutaway model, showing the S-19's revolutionary triple hybrid engines, which could transform from air-breathing supersonic turbofan engines to hypersonic ramjets to pure rocket engines. "Getting any flight time these days?" Boomer looked up from his computer and followed Brad's gesture.
"On the S-19s?"
With a sour look, he shook his head.
"Zero. Zip. Nada. All of our space planes are mothballed for now. Stacy Ann Barbeau is allergic to orbital operations, especially by anything with the Skymaster's logo on the side."
"What's her excuse? Too expensive?" Brad asked.
"Nope, it's not that,"
Boomer replied.
"She's all about spending taxpayer money. But only as long as the money stays well inside the Earth's atmosphere."
"And ends up in the pockets of contractors who back her politically?" Brad guessed. Boomer snorted.
"I hate to hear someone so young sounding so cynical. Especially when I'm right."
"Well, yeah," Boomer admitted. He rocked back in his chair.
"But I bet you didn't come all this way to Nevada just to talk politics."
His eyes narrowed.
"And I really hope you weren't planning to acquire another one of the X-planes we've got stashed out in Hangar 5, because I can tell you that's a total non-starter in the current circumstances."
Brad shook his head, hiding a grin. Though he would never probably confess it openly, it was pretty clear that Boomer hated the idea of letting any of the highly advanced prototypes stored here at Battle Mountain slip through his fingers. Most of them were the products of the late John Master's irreplaceable genius. Every one of them was literally one of a kind. They incorporated revolutionary technologies and design concepts that might someday be applied to new aviation projects. Watching any of those experimental aircraft fly off into danger with the Iron Wolf Squadron or some other Cyan covert outfit must be like seeing one of your kids ride a tricycle out into traffic. "Your X-planes are safe from my nefarious clutches. This time," Brad promised, holding up three fingers. "Scout's honor."
"Okay. So why am I not feeling hugely relieved to hear that?"
Boomer asked quietly.
He leaned forward again. "Look, if you're not here to snag a new plane, why the hell are you here?"
Brad lowered his hand. The other man was right. It was past time to get serious.
"I've got a team of three CIDs parked up in the hills just north of here," he said flatly,
"because we think the Russians are likely to hit Skymasters next." Quickly, he outlined his reasoning. When he was done, Boomer sighed.
"Yeah, that all makes sense. I wish it didn't."
He forced a tired smile.
"But other people around here see the situation the same way you do. I know the possibility of a Russian attack against us has been on my mind ever since I saw the pictures out of Barksdale, and it sure explains a lot of the weird shit we've been doing over the past couple of days."
"Like what?"
"Richter's had all of his top people,
working like dogs to secretly transfer all of our CID-related materials, components, and software to hidden storage facilities off-site, Boomer explained. By the time we're finished, which should be in the next couple of days, you could walk in here and never realize that Skymasters had anything to do with those machines. Brad felt himself relax slightly, learning that Jason Richter, Skymaster's chief executive officer, was on the ball was a relief. Even though the Russians already had their own combat robots, it was a safe bet that their war machines were not quite as advanced as the cybernetic infantry devices built and continually upgraded by Richter and his cybernetic engineers. But given Russia's enormous resources, it was also probable that Gryzlov's robot force now had numerical superiority over the Iron Wolf squadron, which meant that allowing the Russians to attain technological parity using information they captured at Battle Mountain would be catastrophic. Unfortunately, though, CID technology was only the tip of the iceberg. "What about everything else?" he asked. "All of your X-planes, UAVs, advanced weapons, and sensors. Are you dispersing them, too?" Boomer shook his head gloomily. "No can do," he said. "The feds have their guys keeping close tabs on the airport. And more FBI types are arriving all the time. It's getting so crowded that the trench coat and fedora boys are practically tripping over each other outside our main gate. Right now I can't fly anything bigger than a quadcopter toy without setting off alarms from here to Washington, D.C. Brad thought about that. "Are you sure all of these new arrivals are FBI agents?" he asked. If Gryzlov was planning a raid on Skymasters soon, he was bound to have a recon team deployed to scout the company's Battle Mountain facilities. "Hell no," Boomer said, shaking his head. "We've got spies hanging off us like fleas on a mangy old dog. Exactly who works for whom is anyone's guess." He looked hard at Brad. "Which kind of raises the question of how you're proposing to set up a defensive perimeter to protect us without getting tagged yourselves." "That's a definite problem," Brad acknowledged. "The camouflage systems on our CIDs are fantastic, but we can't run them for more than a few hours without draining our battery power. So with federal agents, and maybe Gryzlov's people, crawling all over Battle Mountain, the best I can do is post my CIDs high up in the Sheep Creek Range. That way our sensors and computers will have a shot at spotting any incoming missile or ground attack." "And then what?" "Then we'll come running," Brad said. Boomer sighed. "No offense, kid, but I'm sensing a heck of a lot of ifs and maybes and hope-sos in this plan of yours." He looked out his window. "How close do you figure you can post your robots without being detected?" "About 6 miles away," Brad said reluctantly. "Which means it'll take your CIDs at least 10 minutes to get here if the balloon goes up," Boomer pointed out grimly. "The problem being that it takes less than 10 minutes for the Russians to wipe Barksdale off the map." Brad nodded again, even more reluctantly this time. "Which is why it might be a smart idea to move your people away from Battle Mountain until it's over? Because burned-out buildings can be replaced more easily than good scientists and engineers?" Boomer suggested. He shrugged his shoulders. "Helen Kadiri, Richter, and I have already hashed that possibility out, and it's not going to fly."
"Why not?"
"Can you imagine what our brilliant president, Stacey Ann Barbeau, would think if she heard we were closing up shop here? Given her long-standing deep regard and admiration for Martindale, your dad, and Skymasters, I mean?" Boomer asked dryly. Brad winced. "She'd think you were guilty as hell in hoping to get out of Dodge ahead of the posse." "Exactly," Boomer replied. "Which is why we're just going to sit here going about our normal business like the good little boys and girls that we are." His face was a lot darker than his tone. Slowly, Brad nodded in agreement. The prospect of using friends as bait for Gryzlov's mercenaries was looking more unpalatable than ever. No matter how quickly his Iron Wolf team reacted, a lot of good people were likely to die. 23. Strategic Command Bunker, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base,
Dayton, Ohio, later that day. President Stacy N. Barbeau took her seat at the conference table with a sense of relief. For the first time in nearly 48 hours, she was back on solid ground. This briefing room was situated on the lowest of 5 levels in the new Strategic Command bunker buried deep below the surface of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. It shared the same overbright LED lighting and drab institutional carpet and paint scheme found aboard the E-4B. But at least it wasn't in constant motion and at the mercy of high-altitude winds and turbulence, or in danger from some mercenary-piloted stealth aircraft or air-to-air missile. Far from it, in fact. This secure bunker had been built at tremendous expense to replace its predecessor, destroyed with the rest of Offutt Air Force Base in a Russian nuclear-armed cruise missile attack more than a decade ago. It was housed inside a thick cube of steel, which was, in turn, encased in solid concrete, the bunker's command, intelligence analysis, and communications facilities designed to ride out a full-scale nuclear war. In short, she was safer here from a missile or bombing attack than anywhere else in the United States. Barbeau caught the eye of Colonel Daniel Kim, the Air Force officer in charge of security for the facility. "Have those Ohio National Guard armored units arrived yet?" she demanded. Kim nodded confidently. "Yes, Madam President. The heavy tank transporters carrying Charlie and Delta companies from the 145th Armored Regiment rolled through Gate 15A an hour ago." He checked the digital clock displayed beneath one of the large LED wall screens that lined the briefing room. "Their 28 M1A1 main battle tanks should be fully deployed within the next 50 minutes. Barbeau nodded, satisfied by this news. Not even those Iron Wolf CIDs could fight their way through 2 full companies of armor mounting 120mm guns. Sharply, she rapped her knuckles on the table. "Enough chit-chat, people. I need answers, and I need them now." The assembly of high-ranking civilian and military officials she'd summoned to this gathering abruptly fell silent. Apart from Luke Cohen and Ed Roch and Admiral Firestone, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, most of them were ranking deputies and senior staffers in the various federal agencies and departments essential to national security. The CIA, NSA, FBI, the Defense Department, Homeland Security, State, and the Department of Justice. These were the men and women who would make things happen. Luke Cohen hunched forward in his seat. He'd changed into fresh clothes flown out from D.C. on the same plane that ferried Roch and the others to Wright-Patterson. Only the dark circles under his eyes showed the ordeal he'd been through. He cleared his throat nervously.
Madam President?
We're getting some pointed queries from Congress. Both the Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leader are asking when you plan to return to the White House. Barbeau's lips thinned.
Not any time soon. The White House is too vulnerable, too exposed to attack. We'd have to evacuate half the city to set up a defensive perimeter solid enough to stop an attack like the one that smashed Barksdale. And it doesn't make sense to tie down the huge numbers of troops and combat aircraft a defense of that magnitude would require.
She saw Admiral Firestone and some of the other Defense Department types nodding sagely in agreement.
How nice, she thought tartly.
It was always an added plus when concern for her own personal safety meshed so closely with military common sense. Cohen looked even unhappier.
We could take some serious political damage if you stay off the public stage much longer, he warned. People get kind of nervous when they start thinking that the nation's commander-in-chief is running scared.
Maybe so, Barbeau snapped, feeling her temper flare.
But I'd sure as hell rather be a lame duck than a dead duck.
Angrily, she glared at her chief of staff.
And it's your job, Luke, honey, to convince the American people that I'm acting in the interests of national security and not to save my own skin. So you do your goddamn job, or I'll find someone else who can. Do you understand me?
Miserably, he nodded. She swung her icy gaze toward Roch. To his credit, her national security advisor didn't flinch. Working for her administration must be toughening the little man up. She'd put him in charge of coordinating the federal investigation into what they were still calling a terrorist attack on Barksdale Air Force Base.
What have you got for me, Ed?
Info on one of the cruise missiles used to hit us, he said quietly. We think either the engine or the guidance package failed, which is why it crashed into a bayou about 2 miles east of the runway.
Let's see it.
Roch tapped the screen of his laptop, opening a